ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Okay, do me a favor and try and pronounce or read out this Swedish word.
Wow.
Holy crap.
Read out that.
Högtrafik umlagningen.
Högtrafik omalgeninnen.
Kom legningen. Legning.
I don't know what the double G sounds like.
Nor do I, to be honest.
Högtrafik omlagningen.
Högtrafik omlagningen.
I liked the little accent in there. That one was convincing.
my ancestors, like 3, 4, 5 generations ago, are largely Swedish, and I feel like they would be very... They're turning in their graves right now listening to my Swedish pronunciation.
I think that was pretty impressive. I think I would go with Högtrafik omlagningen. Oh, God, no, that's terrible. This is All in the Mind. I'm Sanna Kadar. I'm clearly not Swedish. And here's how that word is actually pronounced by a real Swede.
Högtrafik omlagningen.
Yeah, I was never going to get that. Okay, but why am I even talking about this strange word? Well, it's the name of the day in 1967 when all of Sweden switched from driving on the left side of the road to the right side of the road. And just imagine the logistical nightmare of coordinating that.
So this was a historic event for Sweden.
It was exciting. I think everybody thought it was exciting.
They raised plenty of awareness about this switch through a variety of different campaigns.
We even had a song about this.
That day is more commonly referred to as H-Day in short, and that's what we're going to call it from here on out. And what happened on that day is an interesting case study of human behavior. It tells us so much about how social norms operate and what happens when collective consciousness evaporates.
It is so rare for social convention to just shift literally overnight. So social norms do change, social conventions do change, but they very rarely change literally overnight.
So today, the unspoken way norms govern our lives and what happens when they change. You know how when you travel to a country where they drive on the opposite side of the road from what you're used to, and at first you're kind of bumbling around? Like you might bump into people because they're also walking on the opposite side of the footpath.
Sorry.
Or you might find yourself looking the wrong way before crossing the road. And if you're brave enough to drive, good luck to you.
I find walking and running, I'm a runner, and so I find even walking or running in these countries to be difficult enough. And so, yeah, I've stayed off the roads.
Have you ever had any close calls?
Thankfully not.
Okay,
thankfully
good.
Not. Just, yeah, it's a very good thing that the British are polite people, because I've definitely had a couple shoulder bumps here and there along the way.
This is Dr. Matt Johnson. He's an American, as you probably guessed by now, so driving on the right is his normal. He's also a neuroscientist and cognitive psychologist, and a professor at the Holt International Business School in Boston. And so why do our brains take a bit of time to adjust to that kind of thing? Like, why can't we just grasp immediately that, you know, in certain countries, you're on the different side of the road?
This really comes down to social norms. It's really the implicit signals and social conventions that we pick up on quite naturally and we assume is the norm. We do this automatically. We develop habits and routines that are built around these. And it's the classic thing of the fish trying to describe the water. We don't even think about these things. And so when you move to a new region, a new country that has very different social norms, this is really when we run into a bit of trouble.
But in Sweden, in 1967, it wasn't so much a fish out of water situation as it was a whole strange new fish tank situation. Here's what I mean. On September 2nd that year, everyone drove on the left, as they had done for as long as cars had been in the country. The next day, September 3rd, everyone switched to the right. And so everyone was trying to get their bearings at the same time. And before we go into how that went exactly, let's just marvel at the logistical complexity of switching the driving behavior of a whole country.
I think this is a pretty unique historical event.
And I should say, Sweden wanted to make the shift because most of its neighbours already drove on the right side of the road. And most cars in Sweden already had steering wheels on the left side of the car, which meant they were safer to drive on the right side of the road. Bit confusing, but it all holds up. And so, how do you make the switch as safe as possible? Well, first, you need a massive communications effort. Everyone needs to know that this is going to happen. Otherwise, you're setting yourself up for disaster. So, Sweden got creative.
It was exciting. I think everybody thought it was exciting.
This is Annelie Edman. In 1967, she was 15 years old and living in the small town of Uppsala.
So we spoke about it in school. And I have a really interesting thing about this time. We even had a song about this. So we had a competition for best song related to the direction right.
This was a national competition, and you might be surprised to hear the winning song was hugely popular. Strange, given the subject matter, but this is the genius of the song. It was called
Ondated Högersens,
which translates to Stick to the Right Svensson.
Svensson is a bit common. En amatör, Don Juan,
tar en chans att gå på vift. And so the song isn't actually about driving on the right. It's way more clever and cheeky than that. It's about a guy named Svensson, who's a bit of a womanizer, and the song is basically urging him to stick to the right path. Like, don't stray into disaster by cheating on your wife. The chorus translates to, keep to the right, Svensson, otherwise it only ends with a bang. The song is pretty catchy, and it's playful, which means, most importantly, it's memorable.
Immediately when I got the question regarding this interview, I remember this song. It was popular, often heard on radio.
It was performed by the Swedish band The Telstars, and it was written by Peter Himmelstrand. Snälla Svensson. Okay, so there was this whole communication strategy, which the song was a part of, and the strategy was incredibly effective.
They did some surveys to measure the level of individual awareness that people had about this switch. So their survey results indicated that 99.9% of Swedish citizens knew this was happening well in advance.
Then it was time to actually make the switch. And here's how they did it. From about 1 to 5 a.m. on September 3rd, all non-essential vehicles were banned from the roads, so workers across the country could set about repainting road markings, redesigning intersections, doing all the things that needed to be done to enable people to drive on the opposite side of the road later that day. And it's incredible to think about. According to the BBC, some 360,000 street signs had to be switched nationwide.
And one might think, because the level of individual awareness was essentially maxed out, that this would just be a flawless transition. But in fact, what happened here was the opposite. So the firsthand reports of this day was absolute chaos. Surprisingly, there wasn't that many accidents. I think it was 574, and that's like more or less average for a day on the road in Sweden in the 1960s. But for every accident, there was like 10 to 15 near accidents. So people were driving with enhanced sort of paranoia. There were people that were swerving around. People just tried to stay off the roads as much as possible because people that actually were there on the day, and they described it as just like an absolute free-for-all.
There's a couple of photos online of Stockholm on that day, and they show just a mess of cars and people all over the roads. Chaos is the only way to describe it.
Yeah, so there was kind of a sort of sliding distribution from day one. So the most chaos and the most near misses and the most accidents on day one, and then sort of dissipated day two, day three, and then I believe by about the 2 week mark, they were more or less on the same page, but it did take much longer than the Swedish government originally envisaged.
And so this is the question that Matt is interested in. If everyone was well aware the switch was happening, there was no confusion there, why was there so much confusion on the roads?
I mean, it just seems so intuitive that if everybody knows about it, then everybody is going to do the right thing. But there's this massive gulf between individual awareness and then this collective awareness. So if you imagine that you're driving on the right side of the street, you're passing somebody, somebody's coming towards you in the opposite lane, you're trying to make a turn, you don't know if they know that it is the right side of the street. So it's a really interesting window into the psychology of social norms and really this need to go from individual awareness, which was maxed out, to this kind of broader collective awareness. So not only do I know the rules, but I know that you know the rules, and I know that you know that I know that you know the rules,
right.
Which is this implicit level of collective consciousness that we don't really talk about explicitly. So looking at this through the lens of collective consciousness, we see that this is where really there was a lack of collective consciousness. So we had individual atomized intelligences on the road that morning and everybody with their own idea about how they should operate. But because this was so new, there wasn't this sort of deeper level of collective consciousness to really tap into. There wasn't really the glue between people.
And that's kind of the only way social norms work. We all need to know them, and we need to know that others know them.
But it goes a little bit deeper than that, actually, in this sort of predicate process to our ability to maintain social norms, which is called social cognition. So when you look at another person, instantly our social brains build a model of what it's like to be them in this moment. So we're literally creating a simulation of what it's like to be them. We can be wrong about this. We sometimes are wrong about this, but implicitly, automatically, we build these models of other people's minds.
So like we're anticipating what they're thinking?
We're anticipating what they're thinking, and it's essentially our best bet about sort of what it's like to be them in this moment, which then has a lot of great predictive power for what we expect they're going to do. And so to bring it back to sort of the traffic example and sort of the social norms around traffic, imagine that I show up to the UK and I am just the most conspicuously dressed American. I've got, you know, baseball cap on. I've got, you know, an American flag t-shirt. Like I'm definitely American and I'm walking around. British people might well assume that maybe I don't know the social norms around which side of the road to drive on or which side of the sidewalk to walk on, because they've formed an impression about what it's like to be me in that moment based on all of these features of my appearance. So right. This necessarily requires assumptions. We're not always right about this model, but it is a simulation that does happen so implicitly and automatically. So in the case of the Swedish H-Day, this aspect was sort of absent. There was some inherent ambiguity about social cognition as it relates to modeling another person's awareness of the new traffic switch. So in a way, trying to simulate what it's like to be them in that moment requires this extra awkward step of sort of overriding our reflexes, so to speak, when it comes to social cognition.
It's interesting because it kind of makes me think to how things were like during the pandemic, the acute phase of the pandemic, where no one knew how to greet each other anymore. You know, normally, instinctively, you would go for a handshake or a hug, but that was no longer okay, but no one knew what was okay. Do you do a fist bump? Do you do an elbow bump? There was just confusion around the entire thing that usually is a pretty settled norm.
Totally. That's such a great connection to draw. So we see this sort of disruption in social norms, what Emil Durkheim would call anomie, when there is sort of this big sudden shift in norms of behavior. So, you know, typically when you see somebody for the first time, we have this general social norm of, in most countries, in most regions, shaking their hand and saying, nice to meet you. And then we're thrust into the scenario where we're doing fist bumps or we're doing elbow taps or we're not touching at all. And there's sort of the analog here with, you know, the Swedish guidelines of what we should do in terms of the switch. And then, you know, the analog here to the pandemic is maybe I've read the, you know, the CDC guidelines or the respective country's authority on how to act in pandemic times. I know what I'm supposed to do, but do I know that you know what you're supposed to do? Are we, you know, aligning on the same source of these social norms? And I think as a lot of us found out in the pandemic, the answer was absolutely not.
So it all boils down to when social norms change suddenly, we get confused because we can no longer predict other people's behavior. But how do social norms typically develop in the first place? Where do they come from?
So it's a bit like language, really. So there's no sort of centralized authority for a language and language development. But these are communication techniques and they are social conventions that really organically and collectively arise over time. There's a fantastic researcher at Stanford. Her name is Michelle Gelfond, and she's done some fantastic research around why certain cultures develop the norms that they do. And she's hypothesized and provided a lot of evidence for this idea that all cultures sort of exist along this spectrum of tight versus loose social norms in terms of a adherence to a more narrowly defined acceptable behavior on the tight side and less adherence and less diversity around behavior in loose cultures. So America, we're generally a very loose culture. A culture like Japan or Korea is a very tight culture. And it's a fascinating spectrum. It's a fascinating framework. And on this question of how social norms develop, one constant, consistent finding that she's had is that where cultures develop, where there is consistent threat, there tends to be tight social norms. Mm. So if you look at the country of Japan, for example, that has some of the tightest social norms of behavior, this is a country that is, for its most of its history, in constant conflict with nearby countries. It also is in an earthquake zone, so it's constantly dealing with natural disasters, earthquakes and tsunamis. And as a result of being in this sort of high-threatening situation, there's this need to develop a sort of, you can control what you can control. And so we can't control these natural disasters, but we can't control our own behavior. And so social norms are a way to sort of claw back control into the culture.
And just to bring it back to H-Day one more time, it's interesting to note that Sweden sits right in the middle of this tight versus loose spectrum. And Matt says there's evidence that cultures in this kind of Goldilocks zone have higher well-being and therefore are better at adapting to change. So this might help explain why, despite the chaos, H-Day actually ran a lot smoother than it could have, given there were no major deaths or accidents. And it probably helped that Swedish culture generally values conscientiousness and egalitarianism.
It was very organized and it was a nice day, if I remember correctly.
And in fact, where Anneli lived, in Uppsala, she remembers the day playing out much more calmly.
And we were, of course, very curious how it would work. And as far as I know, it works fine. Maybe different where you live. Since I'm living in Uppsala, it was a small city, around 25,000.
And here's an example of that Swedish conscientiousness. Even though she was only 15, Anneli was really excited about the switch, and she wanted to play her role in making it as smooth as possible. So she volunteered as a crossing guard for school children, and her voice still fills with excitement at remembering that.
I was so proud. The aim was to have younger ones to cross the street near the school. So I stood there for half an hour, and then I went to school a little bit late. I liked that because I was never late otherwise. So it was a little bit exciting.
And so I guess every society would have norms. Like, you can't really have a society that doesn't have norms, right?
Absolutely. We do see sort of fluctuations in the example of H Day or in the pandemic, where we sort of do exist in a transient state of normlessness, but then typically we sort of settle down back into social convention and back into norms.
Mm, and yeah, what would happen if there were no norms? Like, would it just be pure chaos all the time?
Absolutely. And this is a state of society that's been hypothesized, and there has been sort of transient periods where societies do go through this. So this is the original work of the sociologist Emile Durkheim, where in turn of the century, 20th century France, there was this rapid sort of urbanization, and all of these people from rural villages in France, where the social norm revolves around the family, now comes into the city. And people, and what he describes in his writing is this sort of society that is completely normless, and nobody really knows how to act around one another. There's sort of intense paranoia because you don't know what the other person's going to do. You don't know what to do when you greet somebody. You don't know if they're going to be friendly or not. There's really this very intense sort of normlessness. Mm. And there's a lot of sort of theoretical frameworks that's been applied to try to understand this, and then sort of how we come back to this idea of convention and social norm over time.
And in terms of like changing norms from a top-down like policy perspective, you talked about how with H Day, there was a lot of public messaging that went around this change that was coming up. So everyone knew about it. But what wasn't addressed was the collective consciousness, the idea that everyone would understand that everyone else was also on the same page. Is there really any way for policymakers to, you know, address that kind of thing, for example?
Yeah, so this is a big area of research for social psychologists, and this sort of idea of how do we utilize social norms to change behavior. And the overarching finding is that they can be incredibly powerful. So if you're trying to get, you know, college students, for example, to stop drinking, you can do all sorts of different interventions. You can talk about health risks. You can talk about, you know, risks to behavior, et cetera. But the one thing that proves really most effective is saying, well, you know what? Only 20% of your peers actually enjoy drinking. You may think it's more than that, but only 20% of your peers drink. So you're sort of establishing at a tactical level the social norms, how the rest of the community acts, and that has a big impact on individual behavior. So one of my favorite examples, which I think is still very related to social norms, is the Don't Mess with Texas campaign. So in the 1980s, Texas had this terrible, terrible problem with littering, where people would just drive on Texas's big interstates and they would just throw litter out the side of their window. And they would spend about $20 million every single year trying to clean this up. And they tried everything. They tried fines, they tried campaigns around Texas beautification. And what they ultimately found was that if they were to inculcate this behavior change, they had to speak to the existing social norms and the existing culture. And what they found is that they weren't really understanding their consumers' social norms and their consumers' culture as well as they could have. They did some market research and they found out, well, whose behavior are we trying to change? It was, and this is a direct quote, Bubba's in pickup trucks.
Bubba's in pickup trucks.
Bubba's in pickup trucks. Yeah, it's an exact quote from the marketing campaign. And so they realized that.
What does that mean?
So this is kind of what it sounds like in terms of the Texan stereotype. So,
okay.
You know, sort of gun touting, you know, Confederate flag wearing, driving down in, you know, big F-350s. Like that was kind of their target market.
Okay.
And they weren't really speaking to that culture as well as they could have. And so when they really understood this culture, they understood the social norms, they figured out that this is a social norm, a culture that really revolves around honor. So it's sort of an honor-based culture. And so they figured out that if we're trying to encourage this behavior change of not littering, we need to speak to this honor culture. And so the campaign that they came up with was Don't Mess with Texas.
Brilliant.
And so this was a fantastic way of framing this idea of not littering within the culture of Texans. You don't mess with Texas. And that, to this day, is one of the most successful environmental campaigns of all time.
Yeah, wow, and it worked, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's also, I don't know if this has reached Australia, but to this day, it's become this sort of cultural moniker. You sell t-shirts that'll say, don't mess with Texas. They'll sell like shot glasses. People have bumper stickers. I think very few people actually know the origins of this.
Yeah.
This is actually an environmental campaign, but it's become this point of like Texan pride. And it really all came from this, environmental campaign.
I've definitely heard Don't Mess with Texas. Had no idea it was an environmental campaign. That's fascinating. Now, these days, we don't just live in the physical world and swim in our country-specific cultures. We also exist and socialize increasingly in the online world. And so, it's not surprising that a lot of what Matt has talked about, like how norms differ in tight versus loose cultures, is mirrored online.
So I think one of the most fascinating angles examining social norms is really how they shift and change and mutate on social media. So we tend to talk about social media as just one sort of big monolith, but as anybody knows who operates and posts content or just, you know, exists on different platforms, these platforms can have very different social norms. And they also exist along this different sort of spectrum of tight and loose cultures. So a place like LinkedIn, for example, is like much more buttoned up, but it's a much tighter culture. There's a much greater awareness of what types of conversations are good to have, what types of conversations are appropriate to have. There's much more decorum on a place like LinkedIn. And then you go to Twitter, especially post Elon Musk acquisition.
Yeah.
And we had a bit of a sort of an H-Day scenario, I think, on Twitter, where nobody really knew how to act. I think Twitter's always been a bit normless. But now we have a person who's saying we should have these social norms. It's sort of coming down from on high in the case of Elon Musk. And no one really knows how to operate in these social norms. And then, of course, it doesn't help because, of course, everybody's at their own little echo chambers in Twitter as well. So academic Twitter, which I'm somewhat a part of, we'll talk about, you know, certain topics, and we have certain level of social norms that pervade the academic community. So, yeah, we do see a lot of this interesting mutation and different types of social norms in the digital world as well.
That is such a great example of LinkedIn versus Twitter, because, yes, Twitter has such chaotic energy, especially post Elon Musk. And so much so that I was a huge Twitter user prior to his acquisition, and I don't use Twitter at all anymore. The level of chaos that ensued after he took over, I was like, I have no appetite for this anymore. I'm tapping out.
Totally. Like, even by like Twitter standards, where it's never been, you know, a normful environment. It's like the wild, wild west out there.
So whether we're talking about social media platforms or cultures or Sweden's H-Day as a specific example, sometimes it takes a big change for you to realize that the way you interact with others and move through the world is based on a series of unspoken rules, norms.
So I think the biggest takeaway is really an appreciation of these norms, that what we sort of take for granted and how we act, how we operate, especially in social situations, aren't ingrained into the fabric of reality. In fact, they are the definition of something which is culturally contingent. And much of what we consider to be the objective view of reality or the objective view of a given situation isn't necessarily objective. It's just the subjective sort of refracted view coming through the mediation of social norms.
That is Dr. Matt Johnson, neuroscientist, author, and professor at the International Business School in Boston. And typically, his research focuses on the intersection of neuroscience and marketing, but he also writes a blog about the neuroscience of human nature. And recently, he wrote about Sweden's H-Day and what that tells us about social norms. And that's where the inspiration for this episode came from. So if you want to check out his blog, his website is neuroscienceof.com. And if you're a diehard listener of All in the Mind, you might recognize Matt as well. He's been on the show before, back in 2021, in an episode titled Neuromarketing: How Brands Target Your Brain. That was a super interesting chat, so definitely take a listen to that one. We'll link to it in our show notes, or just Google that title, plus All in the Mind, and you'll find it online. And that's it for All in the Mind this week. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr and sound engineer Russell Stapleton. This episode was written, edited, and presented by me, Sana Kadar. And thank you for listening. I will catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.